In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I want to tell you about the 1932 Kimberley rescue, when a pair of German aviators became lost on the northern coast of Australia while in the middle of attempting an aerial circumnavigation of the planet. Now, I was thinking about this, and I was going to try to lead off the episode with, you know, a bit of mystery. Ooh, did they get found? Did they ever make it back home alive? Did they survive? But then I realized that the title of the episode is the 1932 Kimberley rescue and not the 1932 Kimberley tragedy or the 1932 Kimberley two blokes get lost in the wilderness forever, or do they make it back? You'll never believe what happens to them. So you kind of spoiled the ending there. But look, even so, this story has plenty of twists and turns. It's an incredible tale of survival and endurance and determination. And to begin the story, we go back almost 100 years to 1932. It's a scary thought to consider that the 1930s were almost 100 years ago, but here we are. Of course, the interwar period, 1932, when four German fellas decided they wanted to fly all around the world together. And two of them, the ones we're going to be focusing on, they were blokes by the name of Hans Bertram and Adolf Klausmann. And they would be the ones who ultimately got lost. Bertram was a pilot, Klausmann was a mechanic. The other two, they served as co-pilot and cameraman, but don't really come into this story hugely. On the 29th of February 1932, the four of them set off from the German city of Cologne in a Junkers W-33 seaplane that was named Atlantis. And together, they flew across Europe. They stopped in Italy and in Greece. They then flew over to Turkey, stopped in Syria, Iraq, India, Sri Lanka, or Ceylon, as it was known back then. And then into Southeast Asia, Myanmar or Burma, Thailand or Siam, Malaysia, Singapore, the Dutch East Indies, Indonesia, and then finally Timor, Dutch Timor back then. And before arriving in Timor, in Jakarta, right, on the Indonesian island of Java, the four men split up. Bertram and Klausmann were going to continue on in the plane to Timor, while the other two were going to head on separately to Shanghai and then meet them there when they arrived later. So, after refueling in Timor, the plan was for Bertram and Klausmann to fly to Darwin in the Northern Territory here in Australia, but they never quite made it to Darwin. They set off late into the night on the 14th of May 1932, expecting to arrive in Darwin by sunrise in time for a hot breakfast of, I don't know what they eat in Darwin, eggs and crocodile, I imagine. But instead of flying into Darwin, they flew rather unwisely into a storm. They became disoriented and, because of this storm, were forced to land the plane. And they had to make a water landing. But that's okay, because it was a seaplane. They landed in a little bay, and this bay offered them some shelter from the storm. And according to them at the time, these two aviators, they thought that this bay was found on Melville Island, which is an island just north of Darwin. They didn't think they were actually too far away from the capital of the Northern Territory. However, they had actually landed over 350 kilometres away from Darwin on the Kimberley coast in northern Western Australia. That's very confusing. In the northern part of the state of Western Australia. So instead of landing north of Darwin, they had landed north of nothing much. Honestly, this is an extremely remote part of Australia, an extremely remote part of the world, the Kimberleys. So it's very, very bad news for these two German aviators, quite aside from how completely isolated they are. They also think they're in a place that they're not, which is you know, not going to be a lot of help to them in trying to get found. But this is just the beginning of the troubles they're facing, because after landing and after waiting for the storm to blow over, they took stock of what they had with them. And the short answer to that was not very bloody much. They hadn't brought food or supplies, you know, dreaming of eggs and crocodiles they were. They were assuming that they would land in Darwin before a lack of supplies became an issue. But on top of this, they were also running very low on fuel for their plane. And all around them was nothing but bushland and wilderness. No signs of humans anywhere, and also no signs of any sources of fresh water or anything like that. So the two blokes, worn out after their ordeal, no doubt, they spent the day resting and trying to figure out what they were going to do. That night, they strung up their hammocks under the plane wings to get a bit of sleep. And the next day, they had a visitor, an indigenous fella. He turned up to say good day, but no one was actually able to communicate properly. Obviously, this bloke didn't speak, you know, German, which I reckon we could probably forgive him for. And so eventually he buggered off and left the two Germans with their plane. And so Bertram and Klausmann, they had to decide on what their next move was after their visitor made his way back into the bush. They chose to get the plane back up into the air and fly towards Darwin, or at least where they thought Darwin was. Now, they didn't have very much fuel, but they decided that at least if they could put some distance between them and where they were, if they could get a little bit close to where they were supposed to be, obviously they'd be in a much better position. So they get the plane in the air and they set a course for where they think Darwin is. They set off in the direction that they think will bring them closer to their destination. Unfortunately, however, the course that they set along the Kimberley coastline actually took them further away from Darwin. And before long, it didn't really matter anyway, because they were forced to land again when they finally ran out of fuel once and for all. At this stage, these blokes, now they're in big trouble. The first thing they needed to do, they knew, was find drinkable water, and there didn't seem to be a lot of it about. Now, tragically, if they'd flown along the coast in the other direction, not only would have they been going closer to Darwin by doing this, they also would have almost immediately come across the mouth of the Berkeley River. But in the direction that they ultimately chose to fly, they didn't spot any sources of fresh water. And so, after thinking about it, after realizing that now at the top of their list was finding something to drink, they decided that the best way for them to find water, to find a source of fresh water, was to go back to where they'd initially landed, that little bay. Now, what was their reasoning behind this? It was actually very sound. It was a very intelligent decision to have made, because there, in that little bay, they'd met that indigenous bloke, right? Which meant that there had to be water around somewhere reasonably nearby, because otherwise how was he surviving out in the wilderness? So, gathering what little they had, with the plane drawn up on the sands of the beach now, Bertram and Klausmann, they set off on foot back along the coastline in the direction that they'd originally come from. It was not a pleasant walk, I can tell you this. It was hot, they had nothing to eat or drink, the flies were out in force, and to make things worse, eventually, so were the crocs. At one point, right, these two blokes, they tried to swim across an inlet. They had to get across this inlet if they wanted to continue along the coastline. And this proved to be a bad move. Generally speaking, it's a bad idea to go swimming in more or less any body of water that isn't, you know, a chlorinated pool up in the northern end of Australia. And these two found that out the hard way, because once they got in the water, they very quickly ran afoul of some crocs who were lurking there. Now, how they survived an encounter with saltwater crocodiles in the northern half of Australia, I have no idea. Because generally speaking, when a croc has you in its sights, especially if you're in the water, you are toast, mate. Crocs will quite happily have a munch on more or less anything that's foolish enough to swim in their waters. These bloody overgrown goannas love to go around eating Queenslanders. But as these two blokes somehow managed to escape alive, it seems that German food wasn't quite to the crocs' liking. And honestly, who can blame them? As someone who lived in Germany for 4 years, all I can say is that it is excellent that Germany has such a liberal immigration policy. So I actually had, you know, stuff to eat while I was there. Anyway, Bertram and Klausmann, they didn't escape from the crocs unscathed. However, even if they escaped with their lives, they didn't escape with much else. As they raced back out of the water, their clothes had been torn from them and they didn't have their shoes anymore. They'd lost their shoes. So now these two poor bastards are naked. On top of being hot, exhausted, hungry and thirsty, they are having a terrible time. Realizing they couldn't continue past these, you know, crocodilian gatekeepers, the two of them decided to return to their plane. And after days of barefoot trekking through the wilderness, they finally arrived back. Now, it's been 2 weeks by now. It's been almost 2 weeks since they were first forced to land in the storm. I honestly have no idea how they survived this long. They must have found at least some water while they were walking. Some sources indicate they had a water bag with them at least, so maybe it was that kept them going. I don't know, but after 2 weeks lost in the wilderness, I have no idea how they did what they did. But after getting back to their plane, where they'd landed at the second time after running out of fuel, they had to come up with a new plan of attack, right? They hadn't had any other visitors. No one else had popped out of the wilderness to come and say good day to these two blokes. And so a new approach had to be thought of by these two fellas. And still believing that they were on Melville Island, Bertram and Klausmann decided to paddle their way to Darwin in a makeshift canoe. This would allow them to get around the crocs, hopefully. And all they really had to do was follow the coastline until they were in a position that they could, you know, go across the water to Darwin, and that was their plan. And look, you know, maybe we can look back in our comfortable armchairs and think, well, what are these two blokes thinking about? Obviously, they're miles away from Darwin. But they don't know that. They've got to do the best they can with the information they have. And the decision they make was to fashion a makeshift canoe and paddle their way to their destination. And how were they going to make a canoe, you ask? Out of one of the floats on the plane, the big skid things that seaplanes use to land. They ripped one of these floats off and they converted it into a canoe. They attached a rudimentary sail to it with some cloth that they had, and set off once again, paddling along the coast. They'd replenished their water supplies by draining the plane's radiator of water, and they were hopeful that their new improvised watercraft would be how they could finally reach Darwin, as long as they could dodge the crocs. Except, once again, tragically, they went in the wrong direction. They headed further westward, further away from Darwin once more. And even more terribly, right, while they were in their little canoe, they actually spotted a ship that was sailing past less than a kilometer away from them, right? But they weren't able to attract the attention of anyone on the ship, and it continued sailing on. So just imagine how heartbreaking that must have been for these two fellas. Anyway, eventually, after 4 days in the canoe, they went ashore at a place called Cape Bernier, and they finally realized or admitted to themselves that they weren't, after all, on an island of any kind. Well, no, they were, technically speaking. Australia is a very, very big island, but they weren't on the little island. They weren't on Melville Island, as they had first assumed. By now, the makeshift canoe wasn't in good shape at all. After 4 days at sea, it didn't have much life left in it, and so at this point, an overland hike is out of the question. They've got no way to continue by water. And so they decide that at Cape Bernier, right, where there was a little rocky overhang for them to use as shelter and shade, there was a source of fresh water there, right? There was a way for them to keep themselves hydrated. And without any other options, they decided, therefore, that it was Cape Bernier that they would wait at and ultimately discover their final fate. They decided to stay put and just hope they would be rescued. By this stage, it was early June. It had been weeks since they'd become lost, and with no sign of rescue and no way to find their way forward to a settlement, you can only imagine the despair that these two blokes must have been feeling. Did anyone know where they were? Would they ever be found again? Was anyone even looking for them? Well, they would have been happy to know that, yes, they were. There were plenty of people looking for them. I'm happy to tell you, Bertram and Klausmann had been reported missing once they'd failed to arrive in Darwin. And so less than a week after they disappeared, search parties were sent off to find them, specifically in the form of ships sailing along the coast, planes crisscrossing the air above where they may have disappeared, and search parties that had been organised principally by the Western Australian government. They sent off some ships and a mail plane to scour the coastline, but as I say, this wasn't all they did, because knowing how intimately the Indigenous communities in these regions knew their own country, the government also mobilised Indigenous trackers and search teams. And so this mob from a place called Kalamburu, they set off through the bush, through the wilderness, to try to track down these missing aviators. And it was these trackers who first found, on the 13th of June, not the missing Germans, but a cigarette case monogrammed with the initials HB, Hans Bertram, And so they knew they were on the right track. This obviously narrowed the aperture of the search. It reinvigorated the search efforts because now they'd actually found concrete proof that these blokes had at least made it to land. And so more and more people were sent off to try to track these missing blokes down from local indigenous communities. And another breakthrough came on the 16th, by which stage the search had been... It had become a matter of public interest. It had gained all sorts of publicity. It's in the papers. Everyone's keen for updates and developments. But on the 16th, right, the seaplane that had been left on the beach by these poor blokes, it was spotted from a plane flying above, searching for them. And this focused the direction of the indigenous search teams even further. And after a boat, right, was sent off to investigate the beach where the plane had been found, a note was also discovered with the plane reading, 27 May 1932, Australia. Today, we left the plane in float as a boat in a westerly direction, Bertram. And so with this new information, the search radius shrank and shrank. Every development like this gave a more defined area that the search party should be looking in. And as a result, these teams began to zero in on where Bertram and Classman could possibly be. West of the seaplane, they knew that obviously, but how far west exactly? Well, after another week of searching, at long, long last, on the 22nd of June, the two poor lost German airmen were finally found by one of the search parties. These indigenous trackers, they found Bertram and Classman 39 days after the pair had initially gotten lost, and the poor bastards were half starved, with Classman in particular really not in a good way. The isolation had worn him down psychologically as well as physically, and the poor bloke, it was quite literally at his wit's end. And that's not to mention how starved and malnourished the both of them were. I don't know what they'd managed to find to eat while they were isolated, but they're in such bad shape, right, that apparently the people who found them actually had to chew the food they'd brought with them before then feeding it to the Germans, like a mother bird feeding her chicks in the nest. Anyway, While waiting a week or so for a rescue vessel to finally arrive and take them away from Cape Burnier, the indigenous search party, they looked after the two of them. They kept them fed and taken care of. But Klausman, unfortunately, he was so far gone that once a boat arrived to actually take them to the nearby town of Wyndham, he had to be restrained. He had to be put in a straitjacket just to get him to actually get on the boat and get away from where he'd been isolated. But they were taken safe and sound to Wyndham. They arrived there on the 6th of July, finally out of the wilderness after 53 days. And after recovering, Bertram, he travelled to Perth. He disembarked to a crowd of 6,000 people had come to see him arrive at this airfield in Perth. And later on, in September, he actually flew back to the seaplane that he'd abandoned with an Aussie mechanic in tow. The two of them fixed it up and he flew it back down to Perth. Honestly, Bertram, he became a bit of a celebrity. He had his 15 minutes of fame in Australia. He flew around the country. He talked about his experience before eventually flying back to Germany in 1933 and later on writing a book, Flight into Hell, about it all. And he seemed to end up feeling quite positive about the whole thing, to be honest, and seemed to also really quite like Australia. Who can bloody blame him? Saying before he left that he would one day quite like to return. But Klausman, on the other hand, wasn't such a happy story for him. He was not in any sort of condition, mental or physical, for 15 minutes or even 1 minute of fame. To be honest, he really didn't cope well with the isolation, and it took a very, very lasting toll on him for the rest of his life. Really, he never fully recovered from this ordeal, psychologically speaking. He got aboard a ship and sailed back to Germany, but. He was never the same man. It sort of broke him a little bit. But Bertram, as I say, he flourished. He went on to have a very successful career back in Germany as a film director, although I will have to pump the brakes pretty heavily here before we start to congratulate the bloke for his later endeavours, because I will remind you that he was German and returned to Germany in the year 1933. And all the success that he had as a film director, all the successful films that he directed, these were little more than just Nazi propaganda for the Luftwaffe, for the Nazi Air Force. Obviously, that was his area of expertise as an airman, so he was put into the service of the Nazi Party, and he seemed to do it quite enthusiastically. He joined the Nazi Party in 1934, and aside for making propaganda films for the Nazis, he also flew for them as well, which, funnily enough, actually got him his wish of one day returning to Australia. Because, as he was once flying over Libya for the Nazi Luftwaffe, Bertram was shot down by the Allies and he was taken as a prisoner of war, and he spent the rest of the war as a POW in an Australian prison camp. So he did return to Australia, probably just not in the way that he had hoped, but I don't know, bugger the Nazi prick, to be honest.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.